Dark Corner. Would you like to hear a scary story?
Greetings, listeners, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Dark Corner. My name is Kyle Kaufman, and I'll be your host on this episode called The Competition. So I was on a road trip with a very good friend of mine, James King, and I was reading some short scary stories from authors submitted for Dark Corner, and I came across this story, The Competition, from the book Seven Strange Little Tales, A Week of Bedtime Stories, written by Cameron Townsend. Now, we have featured two other short stories she had written last season, being the episode Crunch and the episode Ho Ho Ho. Anyway, so James asked me to read the story to him while we were driving, and he really felt connected to this story. He loved it, and he asked if he could actually be the one to read it on Dark Corner's podcast when I feature this story as an episode. So I said, sure. So James will actually be reading for you on this episode. So without further ado, here we go.
The Competition, written by Cameron Townsend. A plume of lazy smoke wafted near Sonny Sedgwick's youthful face and into his handy hair as he sat in the deserted cafeteria of the Harker Murray building sipping black coffee. Piercing blue eyes riveted to the Orange County Register. He set aside the white styrofoam cup and picked up the cigarette. Aware that smoking was illegal in California buildings, he took a long rebellious drag, blowing out the smoke with a smirk when he spotted the article he wanted. Body found in Santa Ana Alley. Police suspect serial killer. As Sonny continued to read, his forehead creased and the smirk faded to a baffled frown. We see similarities in this murder to three other murders that we have under investigation, the story read, attributing the quote to an unknown source. But certain evidence collected from the scene has raised speculation of a copycat. A copycat? Sonny searched the article for a location and saw that the alley mentioned was behind a business off 2nd Street. The story he was looking for should have put the body in an alley on the far side of the Civic Center. He flipped through the rest of the section, locating the other items on page 7. A map insert with tiny X's showed the locations of four bodies with a vague mention of unspecified evidence that linked the killings to the same person. Bunch of amateurs, Sonny thought, drawing on his cigarette. Okay, mister, put the butt down and your hands up, ordered a female voice from behind him. You're under arrest. Sonny laid his head back and puffed out four perfect smoke rings, then turned and grinned at the auburn-haired policewoman holding a gun on him. Oh, please, officer, he said, feigning a whine. It's a disease. I just can't help myself. The officer gave an exasperated huff and holstered the gun, then pulled out the metal folding chair across from him. Sonny, you're stinking up the whole floor, she scolded him, grabbing the newspaper. She weighed the section in front of her with annoyance, turned the chair backward, and then tossed the folded paper at him as she sat. Frank said you better get your ass out to the desk or he'll give me $20 to shoot off your right gonad. Old Francis has an awful lot of confidence in your aim, rookie, Sonny smugly replied. He crossed his arms and leaned his chair back on the rear legs. I'll give you 25 to put a cap in his burrito-stuffed butt. No way you can miss that. Make it 50 and I'll give it some thought, she picked up his cup and sniffed it, then her nose crinkled. I thought you were off the sauce, she said, rising to pour the contents into the sink. Oh, hey, man, Sonny protested, his chair coming upright. Damn it, Rachel, why'd you do that? It was only a snort. Rachel refilled the cup with coffee from a metal carafe and sauntered back to the table, placing the cup in front of him. This isn't Mukwango, Wisconsin, Sonny. If Frank catches a whiff of that stuff on your breath, you're out of here. Maybe you could loan me some of that swanky perfume you bathe in, Sonny retorted, setting his elbows on the table to rest his chin. So what's the latest on the Carnation Killer? Spotting the article he had been reading, her eyes narrowed. Is that one of the subtle interrogation techniques they're teaching at the police academy? You should know, he replied, smirking. Rachel shook her head. Nope. I told you before that I never went to the academy. She sat down and leaned on the chair back, matching his cocky smirk. I'm only pretending to be a cop. Yeah, right, Sonny said, taking a drag on his cigarette. You're not really a cop. You're undercover for the FBI. CIA, she corrected. Whatever. He stubbed the cigarette out on the newspaper and stashed the butt in his shirt pocket. I was just reading that the cops found another body. That makes four for your boyfriend, and you don't seem to be any closer to catching him. You think you can do better? Rachel asked, scrutinizing him from beneath the visor of her cap. Absolutely. You get your HR people to hire me and I'll solve the case in a week, retorted Sonny. How hard can it be to find a killer passing out white carnations? About as hard as finding one passing out red roses. The left corner of her mouth curled in a mocking smile. And human resources only hires humans, hence the name, so you're screwed. Sonny sucked the air through his teeth. Any time, anywhere with you, baby cakes, he said lewdly. Then he sat upright, cocking his head with interest. What's this about red roses? Don't tell me you haven't seen the latest, she nodded at the newspaper. You mean the alleged copycat? Not alleged. This one's the real deal. Then that's what the article meant by unspecified evidence linking the killings. That's right. Everything about the case screams copycat. She leaned towards him. Somebody out there knows about the white carnations, so either there was a witness or the killer bragged to one of his wacko friends. Yeah? So you think the new murders are related to your boyfriend's work? He winked at her. Maybe someone else is trying to impress you. Or maybe to impress a carnation killer. She stood and straightened her uniform. While there's nothing exciting in here, she headed for the door. Don't forget Frank. Am I going to see you tomorrow night? Sonny asked her. Not if I see you first, she fired back. Sonny jumped up and followed Rachel to the elevator, seeing her push the down button as he came up behind her. The elevator doors opened and she entered. When she turned to face the doors, he grinned. How about a lift? Sorry, sailor, she replied with a smirk. I'm going down. Ooh, I love how you think, he moaned, hastily squeezing between the closing doors. How about breakfast in the morning? No, thank you, she replied, watching the indicator lamps. How about dinner Thursday? It's my night off. Sorry, I have to work. He frowned, then tried again. Dinner on your next day off? I don't get days off. Aw, come on, everybody gets a day off now and then. I don't, she smirked at him. Haven't you heard, Sonny? Rust and crime never sleep. Oh, sleep won't be a problem. He put his arm around her waist and whispered, for you, I can go all night long. Her head turned until they were nose to nose. Rachel smiled and kept her eyes on him as she clasped a hand around her waist. Suddenly, she twisted his wrist and made a maneuver that brought his arm up painfully behind his back. Ow! Sonny yelped. Hey, that hurts! I hate fresh guys, Sonny, she whispered in his ear, especially ones in their 20s. Okay, okay, he exclaimed. You win! I always do, she said, releasing him. Apology accepted. Geez Louise, Hercules, Sonny huffed, rubbing his arm. That's a move I can't wait to learn at the police academy. The doors opened into the lobby and Rachel patted his cheek as she went by him, calling over her shoulder, I told you, I never went to the police academy. She passed the desk where Frank Lawyer was watching six ever-changing security monitors and blew the retired policeman a kiss. See you later, Countess, Frank cheerfully responded, tipping his hat. He smiled as he watched Rachel go down the walkway, then disappeared around the corner of the building. Sonny sidled up to the reception desk and peered at the shifting images on the monitors. Which way did she go? Frank shrugged. Mister, she seems to time the swing on camera 4 to the second. He picked up his racing form and marked a horse at Hollywood Park. Where have you been? You're late on your rounds. After a glance up, he added, You've got your hat again, too. Yeah, and the dog ate my homework, Sonny said, taking a swipe at Frank's hat as he left for the elevators. I'm going to check things upstairs first. Hey, check camera 3 in the rear lot, too, Frank called. It keeps going black. Whatever you say, Francis, Sonny replied, tossing off a petulant wave as he rounded a large potted plum. At the elevators, he pushed the up button, then checked the lobby windows for Frank's reflection. Seeing his head bowed, he took a handkerchief from his back pocket and started for the rear of the building. As he passed each office, he tapped a knuckle to the door, listening for a reply before using the handkerchief to try the knob. Every locked door brought another huff of irritation. When he reached the back door, he released the upper and lower lock bolts and went outside. There were only four cars in the rear lot. Frank's forest green 98 Honda Accord, a silver BMW 740i, a white Mercedes S600, and a black 91 Lotus Elan. Look at that shit, Sonny thought. Bunch of egotistical morons with more money than brains. Careful to avoid the rotating camera mounted above him, he hurried to the bushes on his left where he crouched and retrieved the handle of a broken rake. Standing close to the wall, he jiggled camera 3 with it. After a couple of taps, the red light flickered and went out. He waited to see if the tiny red light would come back on, then tossed the rake into the bushes, pulled a key from his front pocket, and ran over to the Honda. As Sonny drove out of the parking lot in Frank Loya's car and headed up the street, the black Lotus roared to life and followed. At the same time, Frank looked up from his racing form just as the black square on the monitors switched from camera 3 to camera 6 on the roof. Satisfied that all was well, he looked back at the form and marked the number 5 horse in the 4th race. It was 30 minutes before Frank Loya looked at the monitors again and saw a black square for camera 3. "Damn it, Sonny." He grabbed his walkie-talkie and said, "Loya to Sedgwick." He released the button and waited. "Sedgwick, come back." No reply. "Sedgwick, you worthless piece of crap," he grumbled, slamming the form on the desk. He pushed his chair back and stood, adjusting his gun belt as he turned, then jerked to a halt. "Sedgwick to Loya. You want the paramedics, Francis?" Sonny said into his walkie-talkie, grinning like a wolf. "You don't look so good." Frank exhaled and briefly closed his eyes, shifting his jaw with annoyance. "You asshole, Sedgwick. You almost gave me a heart attack." Still grinning, Sonny hooked his walkie-talkie on his belt, then straightened Frank's hat, narrowly avoiding getting his hand slapped for the effort. "Sorry, Francis." "Cut the crap. Why didn't you answer me?" asked Frank, hiking up his trousers before he sat. "Camera 3 is black again." He sneered at Sonny when he pushed aside the racing form and a half-eaten carne asada burrito and sat on the desk. "Well?" "Well, what?" Sonny asked, lifting his hands. "You told me to look at camera 3, so I had to go down to the basement for a ladder. There's no reception down there." This caught Frank off guard. "Oh, that's right," he mumbled. He shifted in his chair, then looked up, wearing a gruff expression. "Well, did you fix it?" Sonny gave Frank a look of smug satisfaction and nodded at the monitor. "Does it look fixed?" The 6 monitors were all displaying shots inside and outside of the building, and Frank watched to see that none went black as the camera switched. After a minute, he reached behind his head and scratched under his hat. "I guess so," he conceded. He looked at Sonny and shook a warning finger. "But if it doesn't stay on this time, I'm getting someone out here." "Whatever floats your boat," said Sonny as he stood. "You know, Sedgwick, if you expect to get on the police force," Frank warned him, "you better lose that punk-ass attitude real quick. They don't like divas and wise guys." Sonny sniffed. "I'm not asking them to like me. I just want them to hire me." He grabbed the front of his blue shirt and gave it a little shake. "I'm not wearing this stupid uniform forever." "Don't start that crap," Frank cautioned him. "With your drinking problem, you're lucky to have this job." "Oh, kiss my ass, Frank," Sonny snapped. "You think you're special just because they let you wear a gun." Frank frowned and worked his jaw, his head tilting left. "Say, what's with you, Sedgwick? Are you at the booze again?" "You know, you're a real asshole," retorted Sonny in an aggravated voice. "So I'll just pretend I didn't hear that." "Great. Then I'll just pretend that I'm not about to smack you upside your big, fat, stupid head." "Hey, you can stick it where the sun don't shine, Francis." With that, Sonny spun on his heel and strode towards the elevators. "I've got to finish my rounds before I punch somebody." For the remainder of his shift, Sonny Sedgwick avoided Frank Loya, only speaking to him over the walkie-talkie while he took his time wandering the empty building, checking knobs with his handkerchief. He liked going through other people's things without them knowing it. The anticipation of finding an unlocked office was like a drug high without the hangover. When he came to the last office on the 6th floor, the door opened. "Yahtzee," he hissed, grinned as he slipped inside and closed the door behind him. Judging from the decor, teakwood paneled walls covered with large framed photos of a boat, a large painting of the same boat, numerous plaques, racing trophies, and a brass porthole mirror, the attorney who had the office was into yacht racing. Sonny went around the desk and sat in the tall, button-tucked leather chair, eager to begin rummaging through the drawers for hidden treasures, when a folded paper propped against the telephone caught his eye. He frowned. The paper had Simon Sedgwick written on it. What the hell? He made a rapid inspection of the office for little red lights on hidden cameras, but saw none, so his attention returned to the note. The handwriting was neat, modest, and ordinary, yet it seemed familiar. Using his handkerchief, he picked up the note, careful not to touch it as he opened it. "Good evening, Mr. Sedgwick," the note began. Sonny skipped to the bottom of the note for the signature. It read only, "I never lose." A chill shot up his spine and he rubbed his chin. Then he continued to read. "You will forgive me, I trust, for not greeting you in person. However, as you have seen in the newspapers, I spend my time in more intriguing pursuits. I have been watching you for several days, Mr. Sedgwick, and I find that you show hints of promise. You might even say that you are an inspiration. The white carnation is a lovely touch. Nevertheless, as you sit here reading this note, I am prepared to exceed your body count by one." At this declaration, Sonny jerked with discomfiture. "My purpose in writing to you is to suggest something of a competitive endeavor. As I'm only in town for another 2 weeks, the time limitation should serve to make our game more interesting. Should you decide to accept my challenge, you will find a key under the telephone." Right away, the handkerchief raised the base of the phone, revealing a small, round-headed brass key, which Sonny pulled out to examine for a moment before he read on. "If by some peculiar mischance you happen to prevail in our competition, I shall send an address where you may locate a box with the lock for which that key is intended. Inside the box you will find circulated, unmarked bills totaling $175,000. Sonny leaned back and ran his fingers through his hair, exhaling an incredulous breath before he resumed reading. "Naturally, should you decline this challenge, you will forfeit the money. I shall then pass your name on to those stalwart investigators whom you have thus far managed to evade. Please be aware that the man to whom this office belongs knows nothing of this offer. Should you attempt to learn my identity, you will only waste valuable, and I say valuable with considerable emphasis, time. Oh, one last thing. In the middle drawer in front of you is a token of my sincerity. And please remember, Mr. Sedgwick, I never lose." Immediately, Sonny opened the drawer. Inside it rested a single long-stemmed red rose. His heart pounding in his throat, Sonny gingerly lifted the rose and studied it. Someone was out to ruin him by telling the police that he was the carnation killer. Who would do that? Whoever it was, he had to stop them. He pushed the drawer shut, wiped it clean, and grabbed the note, then stuffed it into his pocket. After hurriedly turning off the light and closing the door, he ran down the hall for the elevator. When he reached the lobby, Sonny discarded the rose and forced himself to walk calmly towards the desk. The two graveyard shift security guards were already there talking to Frank, and they all looked up as he approached. "How's it hanging, Dick Tracy?" smirked the taller man. "Just peachy, thanks," Sonny replied as he walked by him. "Shot anyone lately, Deputy Fife?" "Why, you piece of... the man stammered. "Hey, that's not funny," scolded the man's annoyed partner. "The shooting was an accident." "Tell that to the guy's wife and five kids," Sonny retorted. "See you tomorrow, Francis," he happily added over his shoulder. Once outside, Sonny turned right and started to run through the front parking lot, hoping he had not missed the last bus. As he rounded a blind corner for 17th Street, he bumped hard into someone coming from the opposite direction, knocking him down. "Oh, man," he said, reaching out to help the police officer up from the pavement. "I'm really sorry, officer. I didn't see you. My bus is over there and I didn't want to..." He straightened abruptly as the bus pulled from the curb and drove away. "Hey, wait up, you jerk," he yelled, and then added, "Thanks a lot, asshole." The officer grabbed his hand. "Asshole's right, Sonny," Rachel snapped, snatching her hat from the sidewalk before pulling herself to her feet. "Why don't you buy a freaking car?" "Rachel," he said in surprise, "what are you doing here?" "Checking out a vandalism report," she said with irritation. She winced and rolled her left shoulder. "I think you bent it." "Hey, I'm sorry. I was watching the bus and I didn't see you." He looked around and spotted a Denny's restaurant behind a nearby gas station. "Here, let me buy you a cup of coffee." Rachel dusted off her trousers and adjusted her cap. "No, thank you. You've done enough for me for one night." "Oh, come on. At least let me do it to apologize." Her head canted, and Rachel frowned, then grabbed his arm and checked his watch. "Okay, fine. Let's get it over with or you'll never stop bugging me." Sonny smiled. "There's a method to my madness." "So I noticed," she replied in resignation. The restaurant was unusually busy, but they found a booth near the back door, and Sonny ordered two cups of coffee from a perky young waitress. She quickly brought the coffee and then hastened on to another table. As he took a sip, he noticed from the way she glanced at his watch and then separated the blinds with her fingers to peer out at the parking lot that Rachel seemed uneasy. "You want these blinds up?" he asked, reaching for the cord. "No," Rachel shouted. Seeing the startled look on his face, she gave an apologetic smile. "Sorry," she said more calmly. "I'm supposed to be on patrol." "Oh, right," he said, nodding. Without thinking, he reached into his shirt pocket for his cigarettes, inadvertently flipping the note with the challenge onto the table. "You can't smoke in here," Rachel reminded him, reaching for the folded paper. Instantly, he grabbed her hand, causing her to look at him in bafflement. Recognizing the panicky look in his eyes, she yanked her hand away with the note. "That's private," Sonny told her somewhat menacingly. "Give it back." Rachel raised the note in the air and snickered. "What is it? A mushy love letter?" She shook it open, holding it up out of his reach, and smiling broadly began to read it. "Damn it, Rachel, give it up," Sonny snapped. He grabbed her arm, bumping his cup and spilling some coffee. To his surprise, her other hand shot out and caught him by the throat. She turned her attention from the note and looked him in the eye. "Sit down," she said, her voice subdued yet commanding. She waited until she felt him relax, then released him, glaring at him as he settled in his seat and rubbed his neck. "Where did you get this?" she demanded to know, lowering the note to the table. Sonny stared at her with a mix of confusion and trepidation. "Where'd I get it? Don't you mean what's it about?" He winced, then loosened his tie to massage his throat before sipping his coffee. "I know what it's about. Where did you get it?" He sat up in astonishment. "You know what it's about?" "It's about you playing detective, you big dope," she said, her voice annoyed. "Now for the last time, where did you get it?" Okay, I found it in one of the offices, all right?" Rachel continued to glare at him, her lips pressed together. "Look, what the hell is going on?" he asked in a harsh tone. For a moment, Rachel glanced away, as though she were considering something. Then she leaned close, and he did the same. "Do you believe in the supernatural?" she whispered. "What, like ghosts and goblins and witches crap?" She nodded. "And werewolves and vampires?" Sonny laughed. "How stupid do you think I am?" Answering that could take all night. "Do you or don't you?" "Of course not," he grew serious, then said, "although..." Rachel sat forward in expectation. "Yes?" That Harmony chick on Buffy was pretty damn hot. Her posture sagging, Rachel covered her face with her hands. "What? What did I say?" Sonny asked. Suddenly, she grabbed the front of his shirt and pulled his face within 2 inches of hers. "I'm not screwing around here, Sonny," she growled at him. "You've got a vampire after you." Sonny laughed. "What the hell are you talking about?" "I'm talking about blood-sucking, no reflection, changing into bats, vampires," she said in a harsh whisper, holding his shirt. "Now, are you going to listen to me or crack jokes? Because if you're not going to take me seriously, I've got better things to do." "Fine, go ahead and talk," he told her. "I'm all ears." "You better be." Rachel studied his face, then let go of him. "These murders," she began, watching his expression for his signs of amusement. "They're a game, a competition, like it says in that note. No one is saying it, but I know the second killer, the one leaving red roses, is a vampire." When Sonny smiled, she pointed a finger at him and his face went solemn. "Look, I know this sounds insane," she went on, "but the 5 bodies of the Rose Killer all showed an unaccountable loss of blood. Official word is the murders happened elsewhere, then the killer left the victims where someone would find them. But the truth is, the slashed throats are just a subterfuge, a cover-up. Those wounds were made after the victim had his blood sucked out to hide the bite marks." In spite of his intention just to humor her, Sonny sat forward. The conviction in her voice was persuasive. "Okay, let's suppose for a minute that I believe you. Why address that note to me?" "Because, stupid, the vampire thinks you're the one doing the Carnation murders." "What? Why would anyone think that?" "Why else would you steal Frank's car and go snooping around the crime scenes?" "I never stole Frank's car. Who told you that bullshit lie?" Rachel pursed her lips and her eyes narrowed. "Okay, fine. Maybe I borrowed it. Who told you?" "It doesn't matter. Are you going to let me finish?" "Oh, please do," Sonny said sarcastically. "I'm enthralled." Exhaling in aggravation, Rachel continued. "Except for the type of flowers, the Rose Killer's MO is identical to the Carnation Killer's. Unaccountable blood loss and the slashed throat cover-up. Since the Rose murder started later, that killer must be the copycat, and I think both killers are vampires involved in some crazy game. Obviously, you were spotted playing Columbo at one or more of the murder scenes, so the Rose Killer thinks that you're the Carnation Killer." She shook her head. "You're in a heap of bandini, mister." Sonny hunched over his coffee, his eyes fixed on Rachel. What if what she was telling him was true? What if there were 2 vampires out there? What if one was after him? Finally, he let out a long, weary sigh. "You know what? For the sake of argument, I'm going to believe you." He stood and reached behind him for his wallet, pulling out $3 and dropping them on the table. "When I wake up tomorrow, if I still believe you, then I'll worry." You better worry now, hotshot, Rachel retorted as she slid from the booth and stood. You're not going to make it through another night. She pushed past him and headed for the door, not bothering to see if he followed her. Once outside, she strode down 17th Street towards the 55 freeway, then turned to the darkened building and headed around the back. As she reached her patrol car, she saw a black Lotus with heavily tinted windows parked next to it. She was about to open up her car door when she heard running footsteps behind her. Hey, wait up, Red! Rachel turned to see Sunny Sedgwick slow to a fast walk and hold out a white carnation. Look what I just found in the planter in front of Denny's, he said with an impish grin. Very funny, she said, accepting the flower. She leaned back against the side of the patrol car and smiled. I suppose now you think I'll give you a ride home. Well, the thought had occurred to me. His grin widened, and he stepped forward until he was only a few inches from her. Tell me something, he said, toying with the collar of her uniform. The newspaper said the copycat, the Rose Killer, had four victims. Why did you say five? Rachel tensed, unsure whether it was the question or from having him so close. Did I? She reached out to smooth his necktie and rested her hand on his chest. Must have been a slip of the tongue, something like that. Grasping his cheap tie, she pulled him to her, giving him a long, sulfur kiss. Engulfed by her musky perfume, Sunny wrapped his arms around her waist and returned the kiss. The perfume was intense but enticing, and he pressed the length of his body to hers, only slightly surprised when she began to rub against his crotch. He moaned and buried his face in her hair. How did you know about Frank's car? He asked huskily, his hand slipping between her legs. I've been following you, she replied as his hand began to massage her hidden treasure. Why did you go to the crime scene? I lost a cufflink, he breathed at her ear. He looked up at her face, seeing her eyes half closed as she began to succumb to his intimate attentions. Why have you been following me? All at once, Rachel grabbed Sunny's shoulders, swung him around, and slammed him hard against the car, her eyes flashing. Because your kind has a knack for causing problems. With that, she ripped open his shirt and bit him on the neck. Sunny let out a yelp and clutched Rachel by the waist, rapidly spinning her and pinning her against the car. At the stunned look on her face, he smirked, then his tongue licked his blood from the corner of her mouth. I had a feeling about you, he murmured. You're way too strong, but your perfume totally threw me. A smile spread over Rachel's bloody lips. You had me fooled at first, too, always reeking of cigarettes and whiskey, but your blood is definitely Malkavian vamp. Sunny's fingers played with her hair, pretending to be a cop. I should have known. Ventru? Without warning, he bared his teeth and sank them into her neck, only to fall flat on his stomach against the car when she evaporated into mist. Then his head jerked back and something cut his throat. His hands flew to the wound, and he whirled about, shocked to see Frank Loya standing behind Rachel wearing a chauffeur's uniform and holding a long-stemmed red rose. The note was a little theatrical, Frank, Rachel told him in a cheery tone, while wiping off the bloody knife. Frank shrugged. My apologies. Enthusiasm overcame me. I certainly understand that. This one was most aggravating. She returned the knife to Frank and then smiled at Sunny. I did try to warn you in the note, Sunny. I never lose. Stunned by the unexpected turn of events, Sunny Sedgwick tried to speak until something pointed pierced his heart. Eyes wide, he collapsed onto the pavement and disintegrated into dust. By the way, Sunny, Rachel said in an irked voice to his remains, returning the bloody stake to the hollow nightstick on her belt, I'm not Ventru. She accepted the red rose Frank held out to her and dropped it on Sunny's ashes, then smiled. I am a Dracula. For those of us who are true vampires, pathetic mutants like you are thoroughly disgusting. Her hands went to her hips and she leaned down, adding, You can't even transmogrify. Well done, Countess, Frank remarked. That creature was a complete and utter embarrassment to the community. That said, he opened the door of the Black Lotus and made a respectful bow. Would your ladyship care to drive, or shall I? No, you drive, Rachel said, slipping into the passenger seat. Only stop if you see any of those fast food people out for a smoke. I gotta get the taste of this idiot out of my mouth.
All right, well, that was quite a twist at the end. Didn't expect a vampire rivalry there, did you? This first part of the story gave me Seven vibes, which is one of my favorite movies, starring Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt. Gwyneth Paltrow's in it as well. I kind of got a sense of it between the two different murderers. And then, of course, leaving a clue behind on each victim, whether it be the carnation or the rose. even though I totally took a different turn from Seven, becoming Supernatural. But it, like I said, it definitely reminded me of the kind of grittiness Seven had. So the author featured on this episode is Cameron Townsend, and this story is actually one of several stories in a book she has called Seven Strange Little Tales, A Week of Bedtime Stories, and it can be found on Amazon. And you can also find her author page on Facebook. She is also the author of the Lenore Gray novels, which can also be found on Amazon and Kindle Unlimited. So I want to thank Cameron for letting us read this story on this episode of Dark Corner. And I also want to thank James King for volunteering to read this for us. I think he did a really great job and really built the environment to give us those creepy vibes between these two characters that were ultimately vampires. So before I end this episode, lately I've been talking about a scary movie, and I belong to a few horror groups online, and there's been a lot of chatter of a new Scream film. This one is actually Scream 7, and Neve Campbell has signed on, Courtney Cox has signed on, as well as Kevin Williamson to direct it. Kevin Williamson is actually the reason I became a writer and filmmaker. The movie Scream is my ultimate favorite film. It's the movie that inspired me to be a filmmaker. I first saw it when I was 14 in the theater, and it just blew me away. I mean, it was so clever to have a bunch of intelligent characters making fun of horror movies and characters committing ultimate sins in horror movies, such as running up the stairs when they should be running out the front door. Meanwhile, these things later happen to these characters. Sydney tries to run out the front door, but the chain lock won't allow her to leave, so she has to run up the stairs. And it just goes on and on. It's such a clever, witty film. And Kevin Williamson wrote it, Wes Craven directed it. And I am ecstatic that there will be a Scream 7. Now, I do think this should be the final film. I think the film should be all about Sydney, and I think she should have a kick-ass scene with Ghostface. And I mean, the ultimate fight. And in the series, obviously with our final girl finishing Ghostface off once and for all. But anyway, I'm really excited about it, mainly because when Wes Craven passed away, who directed Scream 1, 2, 3, and 4, it was... We as fans were not really thrilled when a new director came on, but it wasn't just a new director. It was two directors, and they did an amazing job, in my opinion, on Scream 5 and continued on with the thrills in Scream 6. So the fact that Kevin Williamson, the original writer of Scream, Scream 2, and Scream 4, I think that's a real good way to end the series and a good way to respect Wes Craven's legacy as the director of the first four films. So I don't know when Scream 7 will come out. If you watch Scream 3, Sydney and Patrick Dempsey's character Derek kind of alluded to a relationship that was brought up in Scream 5, so maybe he'll sign on. He did do the film Thanksgiving, which was a horror film, so horror isn't above him or beneath him. So anyway, we'll see. I'll definitely keep you all posted as I learn more, because like I said, the Scream franchise is one of my favorite franchises, and the first film is the reason I became a filmmaker. Okay, so I hope you've enjoyed this episode, The Competition, written by Cameron Townsend. Like I said before, you can find her book on Amazon, and it is called Seven Strange Little Tales, A Week of Bedtime Stories. All right, so until next time, have a hauntingly good week. This episode of Dark Corner was created, produced, and edited by myself, Kyle Kaufman. Our opening music was composed by Mauricio Pridio. Background music during read provided by Moulay Tamey from freesound.org. This has been a Sebastian Films Unlimited presentation. You can visit our website at www.sebastianfilmsunlimited.com and find us on Instagram at Sebastian Films Unlimited.